We are studying Book of Genesis. I'm on page 63, Genesis 11. And we're moving slowly here for the sake of the feeble-minded among us. So, not you, Mark. These are the records of the generations of Shem. Shem was 100 years old and became the father of Arpachshad 2 years after the flood. Now you notice I've underlined some text here, and you notice they're all numbers. So just as we go along, we'll make this clear. Shem lived 500 years after he became the father of Arpachshad, and he had other sons and daughters, and Arpachshad lived 35 years and became the father of Shelah. Arpachshad lived 403 years after he became the father of Shelah. He had other sons and daughters, and Shelah lived 30 years and became the father of Eber. And Shelah lived 403 years after he became the father of Eber. He had other sons and daughters. Eber lived 34 years, became the father of Peleg. Eber lived 430 years after he became the father of Peleg, and he had other sons and daughters. Peleg lived 30 years, became the father of Reu. And he had other sons and daughters. And Reu lived 32 years, and became the father of Serug. And Reu lived 207 years after he became the father of Serug, and he had other sons and daughters. And Serug lived 30 years and became the father of Nahor. Nahor lived 200 years after he became the father of Terah. And Nahor lived 29 years and became the father of Terah. And then Nahor lived 119 years after he became the father of Terah. He had other sons and daughters, and Terah lived 70 years, became the father of Abraham, Nahor, and Haran. Now, God is starting the world over through Shem, one of the three sons of Noah. Using a new storyline with a continuing focus on the Semites in the end of the further detailed information about Hamites and Japhethites. So as we go through here, now remember that these lineages that make up the backbone of our story are a frozen section from Adam to Jesus and on to Jesus in the millennial reign. And everything that's outside of the main narrative gets dropped off, except as it relates to the main narrative. So we're seeing here a very detailed tracing from Noah all the way to Abraham eventually, but because, and with great deal of detail, because we're meant to understand certain facts that are being claimed here. When the writers of the ancient world give you this much detail, they're making a factual claim, because, as you know, when they don't care about that, they give you this broad brush, allegorical, metaphorical numbers. But when they give you this kind of detail, they're making a claim. Other lines outside of the Adam to Jesus line are only dealt with as they relate to Adam to Jesus continuum. This section is rich in detail. I'll talk about that. The Bible is making a claim to historicity. Noah lived 350 years after the flood. Abram was born 292 years after the flood. We get this by adding the years between them and the genealogy provided. So those numbers that I outlined above in the text, if you add all those up, that's where you get the 292 years between Noah and Abram. And so you know that Noah was still alive at the time that Abram was born, and for some time thereafter. Looks like about 60 years. So, who was Abram's oldest relative and the teaching elder of the young ones in Abram's village? Who taught with the most authority and the wise people listened? Where did Abram get his understanding and devotion to God? He received it from the most revered village elder, that is, Noah. Now, these are the records of generations of Terah. So, we talked about a lot of different people in the lineage, but we don't care about what happens in their world specifically. We only care about what happens in Abram's world, and so we're going to jump all the way down to Terah, his father. Terah became the father of Abraham, Nahor, and Haran. Haran became the father of Lot. Haran died in the presence of his father Terah in the land of his birth, or the Chaldeans. And Abram and Nahor took wives to themselves. The name of Abram's wife was Sarai. The name of Nahor's wife was Milcah, the daughter of Haran, the father of Milcah and Ishcah. So, the telescoping of history continues. All families except for Terah's disappear. Once again, extra peripheral data is given only because it's necessary to our later story. Terah's youngest son, whose name was Haran, dies and leaves a son named Lot. Lot is important to our later story, so we get that level of detail. Abram and Nahor take wives whose names are given. Nahor marries his niece Milcah, the daughter of Haran. He had taken her in after Haran died. So this man dies and he leaves family, and Abraham took in Lot, and he took in Milcah. And by the time she got to marriageable age, he decided to add her to his stable of wives, and he married her. Now, the important part of it is that it's through this marriage that we wind up getting Rebekah, and we wind up getting Laban, who Jacob deals with much later on, who Isaac marries Rebekah and Jacob deals with later on. So the reason we get this detail is because we're going to need it later when we get to the story. That's so we can trace this back. So when they give you extraneous information, there's always some method in the madness. An adult woman who was adopted in a household would eventually become a wife or a concubine. All women were expected to and wanted to bear children, and they saw it as their raison d'etre. So they often were somewhat indifferent concerning who provided the seed. This was not the age of romantic love. All they wanted was to make sure they had children, and in many cases they could care less who they got married to as long as he was fertile. Sarai was barren. She had no child. This is a big issue. We have this constant conversation as we go through this area as fertile, barren, firstborn, secondborn, overcoming firstborn. I mean, it's this whole theme as we go down through history. Even Rebekah, we're told, was barren for a long time until Isaac prayed for her. Terah took Abram, his son, and Lot, the son of Haran, his grandson, Sarai, his daughter-in-law, his son, Abram's wife, and they went out together from Ur of the Chaldeans in order to enter the land of Canaan, and they went as far as Haran, and they settled there. Now, what happened is they came to a city, which they later named for his dead son. That's what we're meant to understand there. The days of Terah were 205. Actually, other texts say 145, and they're probably right. Doesn't matter. Terah died in Haran. Sarai, I covered this here. So why does Terah leave Ur of the Chaldees? Who names the city called Haran? And has Terah's gotten over his grief? These are all issues that show up in our story. We are told point blank that Terah was an idol worshiper, that he was not a man of God at all. Now the Lord said to Abram, go forth from your country and from your relatives and your father's house to the land which I show you, and I will make you a great nation, and I will bless you. I will make your name great, so you shall be a blessing, and I will bless those who bless you. And the one who curses you will curse, and in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. Now, Abram hears Noah's story, and he latches on to the relationship. Other people who are hearing Noah's story are latching on to a lot of things. The story, the blessings, just the information, the facts, or whatever. But Abram latches on to the relationship, the fact that there was a friendship between Noah and God that resulted in all that it resulted in. We are told that Abram heard the voice of God. It wasn't until many, many, many years later that he even got a physical representation of God when some people came to visit him and he served them dinner on the way down to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah. But for all of his years, Abram, the voice, God's relationship with Abram was through a voice. Now, Adam and Eve heard a voice. They didn't see anybody. Moses heard a voice until he finally asked God to give him a bit of a glimpse, which, as you remember, all that happened there. And then he only got just a very brief blip of a glimpse. So Abraham is hearing a voice. We are all born with the voice of God in us. It's called our conscience. Very early on, before we know him, long before we know him, we begin to get details in our heart about morals and ethics. What's right, what's wrong, what's fair, what's not. We can sense very early on when we're doing the wrong thing. We hide our head when we do the wrong thing. And as we go along, and we've almost certainly been hearing that voice since our womb. And as we go along, if we develop the ability to hear and relate to that voice, then we get to the place where we are now, and we can still hear the voice of God. Now, probably almost no one hears an actual physical voice. So when people tell you they heard the voice of God, they do not usually mean that there was a voice spoken out of the air that they heard with these ears. It happens, and it might happen to us once or twice in our life, if at all. But all of us are capable of hearing what God is trying to say to us based on, first of all, our desire to hear. The Lord reveals himself to those who seek him. And the sensitivity that we train in ourselves to hear the voice of God. You know, we're all born with a lot of gifts and talents, and whether we develop or don't develop them determines what happens with them. You know, many of us are born with a musical gene, but we never learn to play the piano because we just don't give ourselves to it or value it or whatever. We have all these gifts. And hearing the voice of the Lord is something all of us can and should and must develop at any age, so that it becomes easier and easier for us to do that. Now, one of the ways we become sensitive to the voice of the Lord is by studying his word. Because what happens when we read his word and when we absorb what all God says and what he does, we learn his Torah, his principles of operation, the way he thinks, the way he acts. And so what happens is he becomes more familiar to us, so that when he speaks to us, we can hear him. And when somebody else speaks to us, we recognize it's not him, because it does not line up. It's not harmonize with what we know about him from his word. Our minds are a battlefield, the Bible says. And that there is a battle going on our minds between two spiritual forces, good and evil. And we're told we need to take every thought captive to ascertain whether or not it's from God or not. And so I like to think of the fact that my mind is this battlefield, and there's a sentry, which is me. There's a sentry. And when a thought comes, then I demand that it identify itself. You know, identify yourself. Are you from God or are you from the enemy? And if it's an enemy trying to sneak in, then you shoot it. And if it's God, then you welcome it. So if you're at work and the thought comes to you, I would sure like to have an affair with that secretary. Identify yourself. Identify yourself. Does this harmonize? It does not. So you shoot it. You know, I would like to give an X amount of dollars to the church to pay off the debt. Might very well be God. You know, we have the story of Gideon, who heard the voice of God. God told him to do a couple of things. Gideon was a shy man. He was an insecure man in many ways. He was the least son of a least family in a least tribe. And he was told by God to go and destroy the pagan altar, which was in the Jewish village, tear it down, whatever. And he was persuaded, and he finally did it, but he did it by night because he was afraid to do it by day. And when the villagers saw that their pagan altar, these are Jewish people, saw their pagan altar to Baal had been torn down and destroyed, they checked around, they found out it was Gideon. They came to Gideon's father and they said, "Send out Gideon that we can kill him for destroying our altar." And Gideon's father said, "You know what? If your God's got anything under the hood, he can defend himself. So you just back off, go away." So Gideon, who is, you know, he'd already pushed the envelope doing this, he gets this further voice of God saying to him that God wants him to lead an army to deliver Israel from their enemies, the Philistines, Malachites, I forget what it is. And he goes, "You know, you must be talking to the wrong Gideon, you know." God says, "No, you're the one that I want to go." And so Gideon says, "Well, let's have a test about whether this is your voice, or as Scrooge said, it's the remnant of a cold potato." Remember Scrooge in the Christmas Carol? He gets this voice and he's going, "What is it? What is it?" And he said, "It's probably just a remnant of a cold potato. It's something I ate." Gideon says, "If this is really you, God, then I'm going to spread this lambskin out on the ground. In the morning, I want the lambskin to be soaked but the ground around it to be dry. The lambskin is a fleece, okay? That's what it's called. And God says, we can do that. So the next morning, the lambskin is soaked and the ground around it is dry. And then Gideon says, well, let's just make sure. Tomorrow I want the lambskin dry and the ground soaked. So the Lord's going, well, I've got a little more time with this, Gideon. So he does that. And so Gideon's sort of stuck. He now knows this is the voice of God. That process is known by the old saints as fleecing the Lord. Now, we sometimes use the word fleece, mean to steal your money. You know, he fleeced them. But when the old saints talk about fleecing the Lord, they mean giving God a sort of a test to see whether or not what they're hearing is from God. And you can do that sometimes if you do it in the right spirit. If God will let you do that. And it can happen. So the voice of God. Abram is hearing the voice of God. And based on that voice is telling him, Terah and Abram's family, including Lot, have left Ur of the Chaldees. And for some reason, they've journeyed into Canaan, partway into Canaan. And there they are in a city called Haran, named after his dead son. And Terah's an idol worshiper. He is he's all about worshiping false gods. And his class with Noah didn't do him a lot of good. But Abram is hearing this voice. And the voice is telling him to leave Haran, take his small little family group, and to leave the protection of his tribe and follow the voice further into Canaan, where God is going to establish him and grant him a great land grant and going to bless him in all his nine yards. He's asking him to abandon his protection and also to abandon his inheritance, because Terah is a wealthy man, and if Abram stays, he's the firstborn son, he's going to be the kinsman redeemer over all of this. So God is asking Abram to abandon all of this, which is at hand, for a promise in the future. The promise of God is greatly backloaded. It's way down the road here if you do this. And Abram has a choice. He can decide that it was a cold potato. Or he can decide that this is the voice of God and that God is trustworthy and should be trusted. And so Abram believed God and it was counted to him as righteousness, and he was known as a friend of God. Now, throughout the Bible, from Adam forward, it's all been about God and a relationship with humans. All salvation's based in relationship, and all relationships based in trust. And one of the things that we get out of Genesis is this steady stream of those people who entered into a relationship with God and trusted him enough to obey him, like Joseph, etc. And that sets them apart from all the rest who neither hear God, nor trust him, nor obey him, nor have a relationship with him. They have a lot of ritual. They're all religious. They have a lot of ritual and whatever. So we're meant to see this relationship. Abram decides that he's going to leave all of this behind and to go at risk. He's going to do the Syrian journey to Germany. He's going to go at risk in foreign territory, in a hostile environment. He's going to be crossing rivers and streams and running into snakes and bandits and whatever. He's going to make that journey in order to obey a voice that's been speaking into his heart. A voice that he's come to have a relationship with. And he leaves all of that security and everything behind in order to follow the voice. See? He might even leave 50,000 behind to help pay off the mortgage in order to follow a voice. You see what I'm saying? Because the voice is more important to him than anything else that's there. And he abandons what he has in hand for that which God has promised him on the basis of his belief and trust. The Bible says if you want to please God, this is Hebrews 11, if you want to please God, you must believe that he is and that he is a rewarder of those who seek him. So when we see these people who are leaving Syria, some of whom are, they discovered that a couple of the guys in Paris bombing were Syrian refugees who came through this process. and had been told that there were hundreds and hundreds more who came through ready to be launched at another time. But anyway, most of these Syrians coming through are people who are fleeing death, and they're coming through here for the purposes of trying to find a better life. But they're coming through at great risk to themselves. People are dying in the water and there's whatever. Abraham's not fleeing death, he's fleeing riches. He's fleeing security. He's putting himself at risk, like these people, in order to obey a voice that he has come to trust as a friend. And because of that, he is the father of our faith. Because of that, he became God's friend. Because of that, there is no one more highly admired than Abraham. Many are admired like Abraham, but no one more highly admired than Abraham, especially as it relates to his faith. Now, he's got a barren wife. God has not just like loaded him down with immediate blessings, but he decides, I'm going to walk with the Lord. When Joshua was finished with his stint as the general over the troops who went to the promised land and did all that sort of thing, he was getting on and it was time for him to establish his own household and whatever. And he said to them, now, you know, I have shown you, I've taken you to battle and God's given us a victory. I've taken you to the mountain and God's spoken to us and everything. I've shown you how to walk before God. Choose you this day whom you will serve. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. There's a decision. We make a decision about, are we going to obey the voice or are we going to do what we want to do? And we make that decision over and over and over in small ways and in the larger sense. And the, you know, as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. I want to be God's friend. There is nothing in this world that is more important and more enriching higher value than to be the friend of God in this world who hears and obeys his voice. Now, that takes the Holy Spirit. You know, I mean, it's not like we can do this, but it takes a decision to hear the voice of God, to become sensitive to it so that he can speak more complex things to us other than don't steal that candy bar or, you know, don't hit your sister with a baseball bat. I will bless you. I'll make your name great. He is seeking God. He started all of this because when he heard Noah, he was enchanted by the fact that a man could have a relationship with God, and he began to seek that relationship himself. God reveals himself to those who seek him. And he revealed himself to Abram. God is asking a lot from Abram. I think I've covered all that. Abram would have been the tribe's kinsman redeemer, the person who took over from the father and basically ran everything else. The king, the HaMashiach, the Messiah, the anointed one. It's good to be king. I think we've covered that the kinsman redeemer many, many times. The heir was designated as the firstborn, meaning the first among his brethren. First among his brethren, first in stature, not necessarily first in lineage. Many of the firstborn in the Bible were first, second, third, fourth, and fifth. Whatever. Judah was the firstborn, he was fourth. Isaac was the firstborn, he was second. Jacob was firstborn, he was second. So the firstborn is one of the highest value and authority, whatever. The kinsman redeemer was given a double portion so he could care financially for his mother, his sisters, and any unattached females, widows, or orphans. So he was given the head of the tribe, and he was given a double portion of the personal wealth so that he could care for those around him who are now looking to him for their provision and protection, whatever. Abram gave up power and authority over his tribe's people and their wealth in order to follow the voice of a God whom he could not even see. Eventually, he became the kinsman redeemer of his wives, Sarah, Hagar, and Keturah, his sons, Ishmael, Isaac, Zimram, Jokshan, Medan, Midian, Ishbak, Shua, his nephew, Lot, and his family, and 318 male servants in his household and their families, and the many generations that flowed from all of these. So, in the long run, he really hit it big, but it was real backloaded. When Abraham goes to battle with his 318 men against the five kings of the mountains in Genesis 14, he is acting in the role of Lot's kinsman redeemer because Lot has been captured there. In Genesis 49:8, Judah is named the kinsman redeemer over his brothers, even though he's the fourth born. And the reasons why the first three were not chosen are given there. In the Old Testament, the word redeemer is used 19 times to mean kinsman redeemer. That got shortened in our age to the word redeemer. Eventually, the role began to evolve into the concept of the Messiah, which in Hebrew is HaMashiach, meaning the anointed one, the one chosen, the one anointed, as the firstborn, the head. Messiah would become the kinsman redeemer for all of Israel. In the New Testament, the Greek translation for HaMashiach, the Messiah, is Christos, the Christ, the anointed one. Hence, Jesus is our kinsman redeemer. In order that for that to be so, he had to be kin, and that is why God made him human. In order to be kinsman redeemer, he had to be kin, and that's why he had to become human. In order to be the Redeemer, he had to have enough power and authority to actually buy us back. If you have a poor kinsman redeemer, you're SOL, as they say some places. So he had to have enough authority and power and wealth to buy us all back. And so that's why Jesus had to be God in order to be a kinsman redeemer to a fallen world, men. Additionally, the tribal family was Abraham's protection in a hostile world, and it would put Abraham and his family at greater risk to leave the tribe. I talked about that. God's promises were for later. Abraham's sacrifices were immediate, requiring supreme trust. God is, however, offering a lot to Abraham. He's offering him relationship and friendship. That's a lot. And if you do the math on that in any sort of a enlightened way, you can see that's a lot versus all of this over here. The problem is that we get seduced by all this over here into thinking that that's more valuable than whatever it is you might get from God, especially in this lifetime. He was offering him relationship and friendship, including the promises that had been previously made to Adam, Seth, and Noah, and the role as God's covenant bearer, wealth, lands, fame, and significance, and the ability to bless and curse, or spiritual authority. Abraham was given those things. As God's covenant bearer for a people, Abraham would eventually control far more than he left behind, having one of the central roles in God's plan for human history, and have the opportunity to have God as a personal friend. A covenant bearer is a person or a people with whom God enters into a binding covenant or contract. A covenant is a contract or an agreement, usually between a greater and a lesser. And it basically says, if you will follow me, then I will provide you with this, protection, whatever. And you will provide me with obedience and service and whatever. The classic example is the feudal lord who owns the manor. And the serfs have a covenant relationship with him. They do the work and bring him that the income. And he protects them, guides them, adjudicates among them, whatever. So in Downton Abbey, Lord Grantham is the covenant bearer for that whole Downton Abbey estate, which includes several small villages and town, lots of people and whatever. And that is very typical, happens even in modern times. When we were living in San Antonio is an extraordinarily Hispanic town. It's like North Mexico. 65% of the population is Hispanic, 35% is German. The Germans make it work, and the Hispanics make it fun. But the Hispanics live inside of a padron system there. So what happens is the vast majority of the Hispanics are associated with some padron, some nobleman among them, who sort of directs their traffic, solves their problems, intervenes for them when they get into this or that trouble or whatever. And it's a very heavily developed padron system. In a town like Atlanta, where Hispanics are sort of blended in among the woodwork, it's harder for that to work. But if you go up to Gainesville, where they have that whole Hispanic village that moved there, they're still operating in the padron system. And if you're interfacing with a Hispanic community on a business, you go through what's called the Chamber of Commerce, because that's how business is done that way. I used to go to Mexico on Chamber of Commerce visits for a company called Kinetic Concepts that I was with. because that's how you do business. You do business with a padrone, and then it spreads down from there. So in places where a padrone system exists, you have the same feudal system here now as there, as we did there. That's right. Yeah, so what she's saying is the same thing exists in Kenya, all throughout Africa, actually, because tribal lords and tribal leaders basically...
Even in the slums,
that's right, even in the slums. And it's just the way the world works. We live in Greek democracy. Most people don't. So, in fact, one of the problems you have, like in Afghanistan, is you can't put a central government in place because the feudal lords, the warlords, actually control what goes on. And you can put Karzai up as a puppet king or president or whatever, but unless he can get the buy-in of the feudal lords, he's SOL, as they say in some places. The covenant is a contract between a greater and a lesser. It spells out the terms and conditions of the agreement, its blessings and the benefits, as well as the penalties for breaking it. Whenever you make a covenant in the world of covenants, what they would do is they would take an animal and they would cut it in half. Now, if you were wealthy, it would be an ox, which is... Ox is just the African name for a cow. So, I mean, in Africa, if they say, well, we killed an ox, that what they mean is they killed a cow. Okay? So you cut this cow in half, and both parties would walk between the halves, and they'd say, whatever, if I break this arrangement, whatever was done to this should be done to me. It's a death wish. If you're poor, they take two birds and kill them, and you walk between the two birds. But the Hebrew word for the verb to make a covenant is berith, which means to cut a covenant. So because it refers to the whole process. So it spells out the terms, conditions of the agreement, its blessings and benefits, as well as the penalties for breaking it. The Bible is the outline of our covenant with God. And it tells us what the benefits are of the relationship and the blessings and whatever, and the penalties for breaking it. It's a record of that relationship between God and man as exemplified through different people down through the ages and as illuminated by various teachers down through the ages. Alrighty, Jacob and versus Esau, Judah and Joseph versus their brothers, as well as you and I have the same offer today, the offer to become God's friend. All salvation is based in relationship, and that relationship is to be a friend of God. All relationships based in trust, faith, belief, obedient faithfulness. It's all the same word, fideo. It's all the same word. Abram said, O Lord, what wilt thou give me since I am childless, and the heir of my house is Eleazar of Damascus? What he's saying is that I'd be glad to receive your blessings, but since I have no child, my lineage is not going to last and whatever, and the best I could give you there is Eleazar of Damascus, who's my personal servant, my personal slave, and we have a close relationship and I consider him a son. Later, Abraham offers to God to accept Eleazar of Damascus as his legitimate offspring and adopt him. God said, no, I promised you a son of your body. You're 99 years old, she's 89 years old, but it's going to happen. So, He said, you know, whatever you could give me in terms of blessings that just lasted as long in my lifetime, you know, that's fine. But I can't have any real blessings because I have no offspring to extend my lineage with. The heir of my house is Eleazar of Damascus. If I died today, he would be the heir. Abraham said, since thou hast given no offspring to me, one born in my house is my heir. Then behold, the word of the Lord came to him, saying, this man will not be your heir, but the one who shall come forth from your own body, he will be your heir. And he took him outside and he said, now look toward the heavens and count the stars. If you are able to count them, he said to them, so shall your descendants be. Verse 6, then he believed in the Lord, and he, God, reckoned it to him, Abraham, as righteousness or right relationship. Righteousness, the right relationship that we have with God is based in belief, trust. Romans 4:1 says, what should we say that Abraham, our father, according to the flesh, has found? What did Abraham wind up finding. For if Abraham was justified by works, he has something to boast about, but not before God. For what does the scripture say? Abraham believed God, and it was reckoned to him as righteousness. It's Abraham's faith that justified him, not his deeds or his works. He was a good enough man, but that didn't get it for him, or for us. Galatians 3:5, does he then who provides you with the Spirit and works miracles among you do it by works of the law or by hearing with faith? Even so, Abraham believed God, and it was reckoned to him as righteousness. James 2:20, but you are willing to recognize, you foolish fellow, that faith without works is useless. James is one who tells us that faith that does not have obedience attached to it is worthless. It's not really, it doesn't save you. That if we claim salvation, but we don't obey God, we're not saved. And so, you know, the whole thing about kneeling down and asking Jesus in your heart, if that isn't a covenant relationship that says these are the terms, conditions, and penalties of our relationship, and if I break it, may this death be to me, whatever. When we kneel down and we invite Jesus into our heart, make our covenant relationship with him, if we do not follow through that with obedience to God, those words are meaningless, they're useless, as James tells us. Was not Abraham our father justified by works when he offered up Isaac on the son of the altar? Yet you see, the faith was working through his works. As a result of the works, faith was perfected. Abraham was demonstrating his faith by offering up Isaac to the altar. He wasn't earning his faith by offering. He wasn't earning his reward by offering up Isaac. And there's a huge difference. Because among the pagans, what happened is they sacrificed their children in order to gain blessings from their God. Child sacrifice was extraordinarily common in the ancient world for huge periods of it. I mean, for 4,000 years. Okay, so extraordinarily common. And the pagans offered their firstborn child or other children in order to earn a blessing, to appease the gods. When Abraham was told by God, go and sacrifice your son, he didn't say, well, that's pagan. Because it was normative in his world. He wasn't shocked that God would ask him for his son. He was shocked that God would ask him for his son who he promised would be his heir. And so Abraham's taking his son up to the altar, to the Mount Moriah to offer him, was in response to his faith. It was obedience on his faith, not something to earn something from God. And that obedience made Abraham God's star. Now, we're told, for instance, in Hebrews, that Abraham knew that God would raise him from the dead. Hebrews said that Abraham knew that if he sacrificed Isaac, God would raise him from the dead. Why? Because God promised him that his offspring would proceed from Isaac, from his body. So we're told that he knew that God was going to raise him from the dead. He was just being obedient. You see that faith was working with his works. And as a result of the works, faith was perfected. So one of the ways we perfect our faith is through obedience. We demonstrate our faith and we build inside of ourselves a comfort level with our belief by following through. Now, remember the old story about the guy who's on Niagara Falls and he's got a wheelbarrow and he's walking out on a rope with a wheelbarrow over Niagara Falls and whatever. And he says, you know, okay, how many believe that I could do that with a person in a wheelbarrow? Say, who wants to get in the wheelbarrow? You know. The faith, the true faith, is the guy who gets in the wheelbarrow because he really does believe. The other people are it's become a mental assent to the possibilities. Big difference. It's the guy who gets in the wheelbarrow that's actually a believer. And the scripture was fulfilled, which says, Abraham believed God, and it was reckoned him as righteousness, and he was called the friend of God. This is James. You see that a man is justified by works, not by faith alone. The same way was not Rahab the harlot justified by works. Rahab the harlot believed that the God of Israel was God. And she made an arrangement with the spies that she would protect them and whatever on the condition that they would save her when they came to take the place down. And then she did protect them. She believed what she did. And so she acted on her belief. When she received the messengers and sent them out by another way. For just as the body without the spirit is dead, then faith without works is dead also. So what we see here in Abraham, that we're meant to see, is a man who hears a voice, that he trusts is from God, a God who is opened up to him by Noah, who he believes as telling a real story. He develops a relationship with that voice to the point where he leaves everything behind to follow that voice, walking away from all he has into what he's been promised, even in spite of the fact that he's walking into a foreign land, an alien land, a dangerous land, and he's being promised an offspring with a barren wife. Most of us believe when we die we're going to go to heaven. We believe that. We're sure of it. We absolutely live our life based on the fact that we believe that. But we have no proof. So most of us are experienced with the idea of hearing the voice of God, believing it, and acting on it. Christians should never be afraid to die, because they should have this absolutely sincere belief inside that when they die, they're going to go to heaven. And yet there's no proof. We heard a voice, we believed it, and we acted on it. We acted on it. If we really didn't believe all of that, we would live a different life. You know, there are people who say they believe in God, but the life they live doesn't suggest that they really do. And that's not most of us. We've committed ourselves to the fact that the voice we heard in here, either because somebody preached it or because we read it and it resonated in here, that caused us to then commit ourselves to walk in this way, that said that when we died we were going to go be with the Lord. We heard that voice. We responded to that voice out of faith. Faithfulness, by action, whatever. And therefore we're sitting here today instead of Joe's Bar and Grill or, you know, some other place. Actually, Joe's Bar and Grill is Mount Baptist. But anyway, you know, the point is that we're here. Now, the thing is that if we can believe that, then we should be able to believe a whole lot of other things that are a whole lot less than that. You know, like for instance, if I give God my tithe, I'll have enough. You know, you see what I'm saying? Or if I walk with the Lord in this particular way, he will develop me to become like Christ. We know what it is to hear the voice and believe, or we wouldn't be, most of us wouldn't be sitting here. I suspect there's a couple of people in the room that are hoping that they go to heaven when they die. But most of us are probably dead sure. So Abraham went forth, and the Lord spoke to him, and Lot went with him. Abraham was 75 years old when he departed from Haran. 75. How many people here are 75 or older? Okay, there you go. That's how old these people, boy, was when he departed from Haran. Now, he hadn't been eating any processed food, so he was probably a little... Abraham took Sarai, his wife, and Lot, his nephew. He took his barren wife and his adopted nephew and all their possessions, which they had accumulated, and the persons which they had acquired in Haran. These are his servants, his slaves, the people over whom he's kinsman redeemer, the people who belong to his feudal tribe. Abram passed through the land as far as the site of Shechem to the Oaks of Moreh. So he goes all the way. Ur the Chaldees is where the Babylonians started. It's near the Valley of the Two Rivers, and Haran is a little bit farther along. So he goes all the way from the Valley of the Four Rivers, actually, to Shechem. That's longer than the Syrians are taking to get to Germany. That takes a long time. Now the Canaanite was in the land, and the Lord appeared to Abram and said, "To your descendants I will give this land. I will give your people this land." And on many occasions he says, "And I will give it to them forever." So he built an altar there to the Lord who had appeared to him. Then he proceeded from there to the mountain on the east to Bethel, and he pitched his tent with Bethel on the west and Ai on the east. There he built an altar to the Lord and called upon the name of the Lord. Called upon the name of the Lord means he worshipped God. And Abram journeyed on, continuing toward the Negev, southern desert of Israel. Went all the way down to the Negev. Abraham makes the tough choice. It's expensive, but it's also priceless. It's expensive, but it's also priceless. We have I'm going to quit here, but we have in our hands the most priceless thing that a human being can have. And it's expensive, but it's priceless. I mean, one of these days, we're going to look back on all that we have and all we've done. And some of it's going to be hay, wood, and stubble. It's not going to be sin. It's just going to be hay, wood, and stubble. It just didn't amount to anything eternally. It was stuff we did versus other stuff we did. And some of it is going to be eternally beneficial to us. And at that point, we're going to go, gosh, I could have made a few different choices here. And this stack would be bigger, and that stack would be smaller. We're going to know that. We're going to understand that. We're not going to live in grief at that point. But we're going to understand that. And the trick is to understand it now. The trick is to believe what we read, see it and understand it now, and say, I need to organize myself around that which is eternal and minimize that which is temporal. Forget sin, you know, and go forward with those things which I can carry forward into eternity. I need to walk with the Lord in that particular way. I need to listen to the voice. It's expensive, but it's priceless. His benefits were significantly backloaded and long-term. Given the same deal, what do we choose to do with our lives? Because we have the same deal. Do we trust God enough to do as Abraham did and make the expensive but priceless choice? Questions? Comments? Every day, you can do this or this. You can do this or this. And remember, what the Bible, Jesus said, lay up for yourself treasures in heaven. You make this decision, it's in the bank account in heaven. You make this decision, it's going to be consumed by fire. Every day. You know, as an example, most of us in here studied in school at a fair level. I mean, we made a decision to give ourselves to an educational process. And kids are kids, and there were good days and bad days. But most of us in here decided to be serious about the educational process. We gave ourselves to it. We did it and all that sort of thing. And now we sit here later and we have to look at that and say, I'm glad I did that. In fact, I wish I'd done more. I wish I'd learned a language. You know what I'm saying? From here, we can see that that which we did, which was odious and difficult to us then, was actually the thing that carried forward. And our ability to throw past 60 yards, you know, that doesn't carry forward. You know, I mean, or a lot of things. So if we can see from where we sit here that we made sacrifices and decisions back there that came forward and benefited us well, and we can see that there's others that didn't come forward, and we can say, gosh, I wish I'd done more of this and less of that, then go forward into heaven. Go forward into eternity and look back upon all of this. Comments? Somebody pray us out.